Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. Scientists have been telling us for some time that we're overdue for a flu pandemic, a really serious flu pandemic. The 1918-1919 pandemic killed anywhere from 20 to 50 million people worldwide. And here we are today, in the middle of a much less virulent pandemic, at least so far, of the H1N1 flu virus, known in common parlance as swine flu. We tend to take flu for granted. So many of us have had it in our lifetimes. You feel horrible for a few days or a full week, then gradually recover and are soon back to your old self. I've had the flu several times in my life. During one bout a few years ago, I had a fever of 104. Now that's high. But after it was all over, I was no worse for wear. And experts say that all my past flu infections might confer some immunity on me now during the H1N1 pandemic. I might not get sick at all, or if I do, it's likely to be a milder illness. Flu is one of the most fascinating and bedeviling infections known to man. The flu virus mutates constantly and even jumps species, taking on ever new, ever different forms. That's why it's so hard to predict and so hard to fight. In today's Soundprint, producer Lakshmi Singh takes us on a tour of the human and animal aspects of the flu. Her program is called World of Viruses, Flu Pandemic.
I want you to take some deep breaths, okay, with your mouth open like this. Watch.
A trip to the doctor's office wasn't exactly how Sam imagined he'd spend his afternoon, but after several miserable days, he folded.
I've had fever, chills, shivers, sweating. I had 104 fever yesterday. So you might want to back off. I'm kidding.
All right, I want you to open your mouth real wide, okay? And I won't use this if I can see your tonsils. Perfect. Okay. Our rapid flu tests are frequently negative. Falsely negative.
Okay.
They're not that accurate. Uh-huh. So because you have all the symptoms of flu, you qualify as a flu-like illness.
At this point, Dr. Jane Halpern isn't 100% sure Sam has the H1N1 pandemic flu virus, widely known as swine flu, that has infected millions of other people worldwide. But she's not taking any chances. Either Sam leaves the Towson University campus for a few days, or he stays in isolation.
As the students fondly call it, the dungeon, because it happens to be in the basement of one of the residence halls. But they are rooms that are not currently occupied by other students, and they don't share bathrooms, and the air supply doesn't circulate with other people, with well people. So they would have their own bathroom, and they deliver the food to them, so they don't have to go out to get their food.
Even though the fresh strain of the flu virus managed to spread across many countries and infect enough people to be called a pandemic, the illnesses have been mostly mild and not much different from the seasonal flu. But Dr. Paul Offit, chief of infectious disease at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, says the pandemic strain wrapped around the globe takes an unusually heavy toll on many young, apparently healthy people.
Virtually no one has immunity to it. Older adults may have some experience immunologically with viruses similar to this, so that they're less likely to be severely infected. But young children or young adults, adolescents, are very unlikely to have ever seen any virus like this, and so they're very likely to get sick.
Experiences with similar flu viruses certainly help global health officials better identify and monitor diseases that show the potential for turning into a pandemic. But Dr. Sue Wong, head of the World Health Organization's National Influenza Center in New Zealand, says the 2009 global outbreak showed you can't plan for every potential epidemic.
The speed of this virus spreading is very unusual, and the virus caught us by a surprise. It was first noticed by the Mexico authority. It spread to America and moved on to other countries. So in a space of 1 or 2 months, WHO has to announce a pandemic.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention discovered that the virus is a mix of genetic material from avian, human, and swine influenza virus strains. And according to Dr. Ruben Donis, who heads up the CDC's Molecular Virology and Vaccines branch at the Influenza Division, the swine genome segments were by far the more dominant.
We know that this virus that is now in humans originated from pigs. That we know. We don't know where. We don't know how.
One reason is that nobody really knows what's going on in swine herds.
And that's because surveillance for influenza virus in swine populations is not really as comprehensive as it should be globally.
While U.S. animal surveillance is widely viewed as one of the better surveillance systems around the world, it has come under greater scrutiny in recent years. In a 2008 report released by the nonpartisan Pew Charitable Trust, a panel found a disturbing number of gaps in surveillance of livestock and poultry in the U.S. The executive director, Bob Martin, says that the study raised serious questions about this country's ability to identify new viruses in animals before they can infect humans and possibly trigger an outbreak.
There's no one really on the local level that's watching this stuff. It's really a pretty serious concern when a state like North Carolina has, I think, four inspectors, and one county in North Carolina raises 2 million pigs a year. It's ridiculous to think that people can do a proper monitoring of those operations.
But American pork producers point out they are doing whatever it takes to protect their pigs, and by extension, the public. Hogs are a multi-billion dollar business in the U.S., and Illinois is a leading source. It has the fourth largest swine herd in the country. Thousands of hogs are housed here at the Bible Pork Farm in Louisville, where it's common to find manure coating the floor, and not one person gets in or out without showering head to toe. Here's the drill when you go to Bible Pork Farms. Leave your street clothes at the entrance, have a clean change of underwear before suiting up in coveralls, hat, gloves, paper mask, and boots, and drop your equipment off to be swabbed down. Dr. Jim Lowe, the chief veterinarian for this farm, warns the disinfecting process might seem a bit jarring at first.
I'll show you how we bring things into the farm.
It comes in through this chamber. And this is a disinfection chamber that all the supplies come in. And once we put the door on, we turn the fogger on. And that emits the disinfected fog. We let the fogger run for about 10 minutes, and then we let it set for about 20 minutes. And so we know that everything that comes into the farm isn't contaminated with anything that could infect the pigs. So whether that's flu or PRRS or other pig diseases.
So we'll do this. We'll go out, we'll put some boots on, and we'll go out, and we'll show you where the pigs are at.
Dr. Lowe starts his surveillance tour with a very special group of pigs that he says can determine the health of the entire herd.
They're gilts, they're young female pigs. These are the animals that will go back in the herd as replacement breeding stock. So when we do the visit, we kind of start here because really this is the foundation of the whole herd. And so we start here and we start a walk through the facility to really say, do we know what's going on? You know, are they sick? We monitor these rooms for health status, et cetera, because this is our best indicator of something changing over time. What I do as a veterinarian is I visit the herd at least once a month and physically go look at all the pigs.
Every one of the pigs?
Every one of the pigs.
How many are in here?
This room's got about 600 in this room, but there's over 5,000 animals on this site. What I want to know is, are they bright-eyed? Do they have clear noses? Do they have any... It's like you do. If a pig doesn't feel very good, they got a runny nose. That's what we look for as we walk through the pen.
Pork producers who want their own pigs checked for specific diseases voluntarily pay labs out of their own pockets, which, depending on their financial situation, sometimes leads to limited testing. To help, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in collaboration with the CDC, agreed to pick up the tab for expanded lab work done on pigs as part of a new swine surveillance program. The USDA's chief veterinarian, John Clifford, says the initiative will bolster testing and go a long way in identifying new diseases.
We're hoping to address and capture novel viruses, isolate those viruses, and then through the isolation of those viruses, be able to produce better diagnostics as well as better vaccines for both human and animal health. This is not a mandatory program, so farmers and producers don't have to call us with their sick pigs.
If the program's not mandatory, the Pew Commission's Bob Martin says the initiative would be virtually ineffective. He believes the only way to hold pork producers fully accountable for the health of their animals is to federally mandate surveillance, especially in large farm animal operations that house thousands of livestock or poultry in a confined space. Martin says these sites are ripe for viral infections.
The barns are very warm. The animals are overcrowded, so viruses can pass between the animals readily and mutate quickly. In addition, because of the prolonged exposure of the farm workers in these buildings, the viruses can pass from the animals to the people back to animals, mutating several generations in a very short period of time. Pigs are wonderful petri dishes, and because of their physiological similarities to people and because of the environment, we've got almost a perfect storm of a great petri dish and an accelerated environment in which these viruses can occur.
Pigs are a mixing vessel for influenza viruses. Much like the spread of flu among humans, sneezing or snorting can release viruses into the air and lead to a pig infecting a human or vice versa. Martin points out that any place where people frequently interact with farm animals can be a hot zone. So it's not just swine operations that pose a threat. He says the poultry industry is just as big of an issue for surveillance.
Well, the commission visited large broiler operations in Arkansas, and we wore a paper suit and paper booties to go in. But we were breathing the air, and we were expelling bacteria or potential viruses as we were in there. To say that they're going the extra effort to protect their animals is just not true. Viruses can be airborne. Bacteria can blow for several miles in the wind.
Mount Air's poultry farmers on the Delmarva Peninsula know how vulnerable they are to flu viruses. Sussex County, Delaware, has the most broiler farms, poultry raised for meat production, per square mile of any county in the U.S. Unlike Bob Martin's experience, biosecurity practices on the Mount Air farm is not limited to paper booties. It's upgraded to plastic. The chief veterinarian on this farm, Dr. Don Ritter, steadies me as I pull plastic booties over my shoes and up to my knees.
We're really worried about feet. Feet's how we spread disease. We walk it into houses on the bottom of shoes.
We also have to slip into coveralls and wear gloves and protective paper masks. Although, unlike the hog farm, I didn't have to take another shower or leave my street clothes behind. But as is standard across the farm animal industry, the people traffic is kept to a bare minimum. Walking into the chicken coop, I'm immediately hit with the pungent power of ammonia. This must be what the masks are for.
The mask is really for dust. Yeah, the odor's not really a problem.
Apparently, the acrid odor is offensive only to the unaccustomed nose. The mask doesn't keep everything out. Thousands of chickens zigzag, flap their wings, or climb over each other just to get out of the way. Jeff, one of the farm workers here, jingles change in a bucket that scare the chickens enough to clear a path. He then spots dead birds.
Another dead one here. A lot of times if you find him dead on his back, he's had a heart attack. Most time when they flop back, just before they have a heart attack, they'll flop backwards on their back, and that's where he ends up. Now, if you have 31,000 chickens in here, the odds of something happening is pretty good, you know what I'm saying?
Whatever the possibility, if Jeff finds enough of these dead birds to be concerned, they'll have to be tested for avian influenza, commonly known as AI or bird flu. This farm is especially worried about particular strains that can spread through bird secretions or feces. These viruses can have low or high extremes of danger. A virus may not have much of an impact at all on poultry, but if it mutates into a more severe, highly pathogenic form, it could prove devastating to chickens.
If it's high-path AI, half of these chickens will be dead in 48 hours. Okay? We aren't going to miss high-path AI. All right, Tom, go ahead and start.
All right. We've got here, we'll take the birds here and cut through the mouth here into the trach. Get a good, clean sample straight from the trachea. And we'll do this on each bird. Take and cut in. Straight into the trachea. Open that up and expose it. Open the vial up. Take the swab. We're swabbing each bird. And we'll go into where we made the incision, to the trach. Get a good clean sample here. With the lab. say we'll continue to do this until we have all 11 samples.
Then the samples are off to the lab and results should be back within the day. There are two ways farms test chickens for AI.
One is an active surveillance program where each farm is sampled about 7 days before processing. The other thing we do is called passive surveillance, and that is any farm that has excess mortality, 3 birds per 1,000 per day. Those birds, dead birds, get collected and submitted to a diagnostic laboratory for an AI test and a complete necropsy.
These caged chickens are on their way to be slaughtered at the processing plant. They, too, have been tested for any possible infections. Dr. Ritter says that after seeing Asia's continued exposure to a virulent strain of AI, the U.S. poultry industry decided to expand its surveillance.
The whole industry probably got going in 2005, 2006. It's really when the Asian flu scare came up. People were concerned about their food, and we said, well, the only way to assure our customers that they don't have AI is to test all the birds. Our two plants on Delmarva process 60 farms a week, 1.5 million birds each per week.
Researchers say people are highly unlikely to get the flu virus from handling the meat of an infected bird or pig, and when it's well cooked, the flu virus is dead. Poor hygiene may be the biggest contributor to contracting a virus. Dr. Paul Offit from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia says viruses are designed to move around quickly.
A virus is like a parasite. It enters our body and then enters into cells and uses the machinery that the cells use to make other cells to make new viruses so that maybe only one or a couple viruses will enter a cell, and then hundreds or sometimes thousands of viruses will leave a cell, and then it'll go on to infect cell after cell.
And some viruses can mutate enough to jump from one animal species to the next.
It's quite common. I mean, we have for centuries lived in close association with animals, and there are viruses that clearly originally came from animals. I mean, the human immunodeficiency virus, the virus that causes AIDS, derived apparently initially from a primate or monkey. Rotaviruses are a very common cause of fever and vomiting and diarrhea in young children. That also is very prevalent in the animals.
Certain viruses hang around long enough to trigger something not as common. A full-fledged pandemic.
These viruses sort of boil below the surface, wait often decades for there to be enough people so that it can critically catch fire, if you will, and then spread across the world.
That happened three other times in the last century, 1968, 1957, and 1918, by far the deadliest because it killed tens of millions of people worldwide. While you might know them as Spanish influenza or the Hong Kong flu, the virus's true identities are typed and subtyped by letters and numbers in proteins that define the flu virus. So the first flu pandemic of the 21st century is type A, H1N1. Type A's aren't so hard to find. Just look up. Wild aquatic birds such as migratory ducks and geese are natural reservoirs of a wide variety of type A influenza viruses. Dr. William Karish, director of the Global Health Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society, says wild birds may be more important to the evolution of a new influenza virus than people might think.
For thousands of years, if not longer, there's been influenza viruses in wild birds. So that type A influenza, avian influenzas, very common in birds. They infect mammals. If they get into seals, they kill seals. So these viruses move around between species all the time.
If waterfowl's the natural reservoir, scientists contend southern China may very well be one of the world's most popular breeding grounds of emerging viruses. It's common to see aquatic birds, chickens, and pigs living near or inside homes in many villages. There's a higher chance for a flu virus to jump from one species to another and then jump the border. University of Hong Kong's Dr. Malik Peiris, who's been on the front lines of viral outbreaks, believes Hong Kong is sitting in a hub of potential diseases.
Many of these new emerging infections, even if they arise elsewhere, very likely will come through Hong Kong pretty early in the course of their spread.
Dr. Peiris sought to know. He helped identify a virulent disease out of southern China that came uncomfortably close to ballooning into a pandemic, severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS.
I think SARS was a wake-up call for everybody. On the one hand, it was a wake-up call to say that infectious diseases can very unexpectedly arise and be all over the world within days. And in that regard, no person is an island.
And that, Peiris says, really raised the stakes in animal health surveillance in Hong Kong and other parts of Asia.
One really has to look at it at two levels. So there is domestic livestock and there is wild animals. The examples I gave you a moment ago, such as SARS, actually arose in wild animals. Now, wild animals globally, there is very little known about what is present. At the domestic animal interface, I would say that Hong Kong really has again showed the way with very intensive surveillance in, for example, live poultry markets, clearly showing the fact that these poultry markets are an amplifying resource for avian influenza viruses.
Flu viruses such as H5N1, a virulent strain of the avian influenza virus, or what's called the bird flu virus. It caused one of the most devastating influenza outbreaks to hit Hong Kong in over a decade. Hong Kong was so worried that the virus would spiral out of control that authorities slaughtered millions of birds and shut down markets. But the experience hasn't deterred people who need chicken from continuing to seek out live birds.
Where are we right now?
In the Kowloon City Market.
Radio Hong Kong producer Sarah Passmore traveled to a local market with a homemaker named Elby, who bypassed packaged meat for a live chicken, despite the risk.
This is the chicken and the hen. Right now, they're still alive in the cage.
Why would you prefer to get a live chicken than just buy a ready-killed chicken from the supermarket?
Because in our custom, we need to a live chicken to worship our ancestor, worship them to protect us, good health, good wishes, something like that.
So does it? Oh, Lisa's trying to get out.
Yeah.
So have you been at all concerned in the last few years about the scares about bird flu and all the rest of it?
No. I don't worry about this problem. I think the fresh chicken, when you don't touch it, it's okay. You just look at it. Also, you need to clean your hand. I think it's not a problem.
Scientists feared that H5N1, because of its ability to spread rapidly, was going to be the next pandemic, until that unexpected turn of events when the so-called swine flu emerged instead. With the H1N1 pandemic, the hog industry suffered a public relations problem because of the term swine flu, or the S word as it's known in some quarters. In Iowa, the country's largest hog-growing state, Dr. Howard Hill, chief veterinarian for Iowa Select, is clearly fed up.
A lot of people thought that it was possible that they could get influenza from handling or eating pork, but we know for a fact that you cannot. So the problem is that the news media picked up on the term swine, and it really devastated our market.
According to Dr. Hill, at one point, the industry hemorrhaged about $1 million a day when countries temporarily banned exports over H1N1 fears. The swine industry is not the only one tired of hearing the S word. It's a big day at the Maryland State Fair. Barns are filled with well-groomed goats, sheep, chickens, roosters, all there for one thing, to compete. But a pig named Bear may be the most pampered of them all.
Come here, Bear. Come here, talk to me. Bear. What are you doing, Bear? Huh? You talking to me? Come, buddy.
Bob Groff gets face to face with Bear and gives him a little reassurance before competition. Groff hasn't named the other pet pig hollering in the background, but judging from the size of her and her animated ways, the nickname Mouth might just fit the bill. The Groffs make sure their show pigs are well fed and happy, and say they don't give a second thought to all the hype over that virus.
Something stupid, really. It was from another country, and they, trying to blame it on our pig. That pig right there is 6 months old. Does she look like she got the swine flu?
Not one
that
bit.
That pig gets treated better than me.
The pig that should be called Mouth?
Yeah, look, I weigh 260 pounds. It took me 42 years. She's 6 months old and weighs 330. Now you tell me.
The Groffs say their pigs have met all the medical requirements to prove they're healthy enough to be on the fairgrounds. But nothing's foolproof. Pig owners at another state fair in Minnesota found out the hard way. Their pigs were the first in the U.S. detected with the H1N1 pandemic virus. Researchers say the animals probably got it from one of the millions of people who passed through. At the time, no one knew if the animals then reinfected any other humans, but the experience showed just how vulnerable both animals and humans could be. Researchers agree the H1N1 pandemic was a rehearsal for the next big thing. It showed just how crucial global health collaborations had become in identifying a virus and developing a vaccine for distribution within months. But WHO Sue Huang says that with so much mystery surrounding the virus in the animal world, influenza is still one step ahead.
The more we know this virus, the more we realize there's lots we don't really know. We don't know this pandemic virus, whether it will continue to evolve and whether it will have a second wave like 1918 situation. And I think the only way we can play the game well is to have a very, very good surveillance system.
Such surveillance may take more of the guesswork out of detecting the next pandemic virus, provided, of course, that humans make animal surveillance a higher priority. Still, Paul Offit with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia says he's not so sure heavier animal surveillance would succeed in heading off another global outbreak.
We're quite good at doing surveillance to figure out when these new strains arise. I think that's happened over the last 10 years. There's much better surveillance systems so that we can act quickly. You know, trying to change the culture of the way that we interact with our animals, you know, pigs or birds alike, would be an extremely difficult thing to do. And I'm not sure for all the work that would go into it, it would make a big difference in whether or not we wouldn't be seeing pandemic strains in the future.
As one researcher put it, the flu virus is one of nature's greatest mysteries, and more often than not, nature has the last laugh.
Yeah, you talking to me? There, Brad.
World of Viruses, Flu Pandemic, was produced by Lakshmi Singh. Field producers were Felix Campos and John Pemble. Special thanks to Dr. Guy Hohenhaus and Dr. Marguerite Papayuano. Also to Barbara Culleton for science editing. The show is mixed by Jared Weisbrot. This program is part of the series World of Viruses, produced with support from SEPA, the Science Education Partnership Award Program at NIH, the National Center for Research Resources, the Nebraska Center for Virology, and the University of Nebraska. You can find the rest of our World of Viruses series on our website, soundprint.org. You can own your favorite Soundprint episodes on CD. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES and we'll send it right out. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Let us know what you thought about today's show. Your comments help keep us on track. The best way to get in touch is by email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org and be sure to mention your local station. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.